Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
You are listening to Unbelievable, the show that brings you conversations that matter between Christians and non-Christians. I'm Ruth Jackson, part of the Unbelievable team, and before Justin launches into today's fascinating episode about whether faith can survive an evolutionary account of humanity and religion, I wanted to encourage you to head to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. There you can find all sorts of resources, sign up to our newsletter and listen to our entire back catalogue of programmes. And if you're listening in the US, then do check out unbelievable.show.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Today on the show, we're asking, can faith survive an evolutionary account of humanity and religion? My guests on the show today are Sam Davis and Andrew Hailstrap. Sam is a former Christian who in recent years went through a big deconstruction. He even started a blog and podcast about it called When Belief Dies. A particular turning point for him was reading the book Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind by Yuval Noah Harari, and we'll hear why in today's show. Also joining me today is Andrew Hailstrap, Professor of Biochemistry at the University of Bristol. Andrew is a former chair of Christians in Science and is going to be engaging with Sam about why he doesn't think that our understanding of the evolutionary history of humanity and religion needs to shipwreck a Christian's faith. So Sam and Andrew, welcome along to the programme. Great to have you both with me today.
Good to be here.
Great to have you. So let's begin with you, Sam. We've been in touch for probably over a year or so now. You've been a listener to Unbelievable for some time. And you got in touch, I think, originally with me when you were still a Christian. In fact, the deconstruction is relatively recent, isn't it? Take us back before we delve into that story, though, about, you know, life as a Christian. How did life look for you up until, you know, a year or two ago?
Yeah, sure. So I was born and raised in a Christian family. My parents Christian, their parents Christian. As far as I know, the parents before that were Christian. Something that has kind of come to me through my parents and their passion for God's word. Really fond memories of my dad reading the Bible stories to me and my two brothers on an evening and talking to us about God, and had a real sense that that God was real, that he was a vibrant part of my life. And since probably about the age of 16, felt like I had a passion to teach God's people his word, almost like a calling over my life to do this. So I ended up going to Bible college 2010 to 2013, a Bible college called Mattersea Hall, which is a Assemblies of God Bible College, a Pentecostal Bible college. So basically, I'd been really passionate about the Bible for a long time, really firmly believed in God, kind of raised in a more kind of sort of like Anglican conservative faith, and then ended up finding myself moving into a more kind of evangelical, probably charismatic to a point faith, and nothing kind of like no slight swing from the chandeliers or anything like that, but definitely a more vibrant form of kind of worship as things moved on, to the point where in 2018 my wife and I actually moved over from Leeds, the city that I lived in since I was really young, to Halifax to kind of help out at a church plant out here. And just before that I started having some big questions, and shortly after that things sort of kind of came off the rails a bit, but I'll save that for later on.
Sure, yes, but certainly no one could accuse you of not having been in that sense of a fully committed Christian. You were obviously involved in church leadership, you saw this as your life, your vocation, and everything else. So yes, we'll get more of the story in a moment's time, but time to welcome Andrew Hailstrap onto the show. Andrew, welcome to the program. Tell us a bit about your own background, both in science and in terms of faith. Is that something that you've had from an early age, or did it come along a bit later?
Yeah, I was, like Sam, I was brought up in a Christian home. In fact, I think I remember reading my Bible from about the age of five with Scripture Union notes, with a bit of help from my parents. I was very much a scientist from an early age. I used to have a massive chemistry set. My father, being a dentist, was able to get chemicals from a local pharmacist, and I did some pretty hair-raising experiments from a very early age, including making my own fireworks. And I think I was very fortunate with my education. I went to a school where my one of my biology masters went on to be a professor of botany in Canada, in Vancouver University. And he actually was a Christian as well, and a very, very well, broadly educated person. So I had a wonderful education. I went to Cambridge, did natural sciences, got involved very much with the Christian Union there. I think my own faith became real in the sense that I thought out for myself in my teens, but that was very much reinforced at Cambridge. Then I came to Bristol to do my PhD on a wonderful topic of the regulation of fat synthesis in epididymal fat pads, if that means anything to anybody. And well, I've continued my scientific...
book, haven't we? We've all read
absolutely. and I've continued my research in a whole variety of areas around mitochondria and lactate transport. So it's been a very exciting scientific career. And I've always seen my faith and my science as very much part of the same truth, God's truth, as revealed in his world, and God's truth revealed in Scripture. I've never seen a conflict.
Well, we'll come. I will ask you whether you have had, though, any moments of doubt, or at least, you know, experienced other people certainly coming to you with their doubts in a moment's time. But let's hear about the doubts that obviously had a major impact on your life in very recent years, Andrew. What kind of started the ball rolling with the doubts? What led you, first of all, I suppose, to start to pick up books that could potentially, you know, cause these doubts?
Yeah, it's a great question. In a nutshell, the kind of reality that the world as I see it could be viewed in a different way. So I came to the realization that I have a very set structure to how I perceive and receive things. So the way that I view people, the way that I view nature, the way that I view purpose, morality, meaning, all these sorts of big questions are very much focused through a Christian lens. And I began to kind of look at things like pain, or look at things like morality, and ask, you know, could I view this through a different lens? Does this world make more sense with or without God? And basically came to the realization that a lot of the things that we work through are stories or narratives or myths that kind of give us meaning and purpose. So a good way to view this is through the idea of heuristics, which is almost like a grid or a pattern or a framework that you place over life to make sense of things. So say, you know, you're driving along and, you know, you see something happen, you go, well, that's because it's bad weather, I skidded on the road, or something else takes place. And you're always trying to explain things with the heuristics that you bring to your life. So for me, things started falling apart when, I had an extremely bad back. I had a slipped disc, and I was struggling to pick up my then kind of like 2-year-old son, and my wife was pregnant with our second. And I was kind of asking this question, like, well, I believe in God, and I believe that he wants the best for me, and he wants the best for my two boys, one yet to be born and one who's still very young. And you know, my eldest was wanting to kind of like run around and play around with me, and I was unable to kind of do these things. And I began to go, well, why can't I be all that I believe that I should be able to be as a human being, as someone who loves God, who knows him passionately? I'm very aware that there's pain and suffering, people in far, far worse situations than myself. But this was basically the very beginning of me asking the question, does this life I live make sense viewed through the lens of God, or viewed through the lens of something else, maybe naturalism or materialism? Or like, what are these words? What do they mean? And how do I actually understand the worldviews that they represent? I ends up picking up books like Sapiens and a few others, and beginning to try and work out how other people explained or viewed the lives and the world that we see around us.
Yes. Let's talk about Sapiens. And first of all, I want to say, you know, I've been on your podcast, When Belief Dies, and I've heard your story already, Sam. So my hat goes off to you that you're someone who evidently follow, you know, you have to look into something. You can't sort of leave a stone unturned if you know that there's something that might. A lot of Christians, I can imagine, would say, well, I'm just not going to disturb that particular sleeping dog. Whereas you kind of go in there and say, no, I want to find out. And all power to you, because you're interested in, is this really true? And Sapiens, I think, was a significant turning point. You describe it in one blog as the first domino almost that fell as you started asking these questions. So what specifically did Yuval Noah Harari write in that book that got you so churned up?
Yeah, so quite a few things. I mean, the book itself isn't perfect. There's lots of great blog articles and rebuttals to the book. So I've got no issue someone saying the book isn't great. For me, it was this idea that humanity is a weaver of stories. Like we as humans have an innate ability to tell ourselves stories, tell the world around us stories. And these stories essentially bring us together, give us a joint narrative that we are then able to adhere to and do more because of. So, you know, the idea that the pyramids being built are built around this narrative and story that isn't necessarily true. Like, we don't believe that the pharaohs were gods, but these things were built in awe and worship of something that wasn't necessarily true. It was a narrative or a myth that enabled a group of people to do an amazing feat. And my question then became, okay, well, if this is true of things like the Egyptians building the pyramids, could this be true of the belief systems that we hold today in the 21st century? So asking questions around Christianity, is it in and of itself enough just to say that God is real and say that he gives me meaning and purpose, when actually I need to be able to prove that God is real and gives me meaning and purpose? Basically Sapiens opened up this sort of understanding of humans' history, understanding of where we've come from and the evolutionary journey we've had, of the devastation that we have caused this planet, potentially, you know, on the brink of extinction, if you view it through certain lenses, and how we have the innate ability to create narratives and stories and use these for our advantage and gain.
You've measured there, obviously, on the specifically the way we have used stories and myth and everything else to give ourselves a sense of meaning, purpose, and frame ourselves within something. Was the actual sort of biology of it, you know, the way in which Yuval Noah Harari sketched out the evolution of humankind as one in, you know, a many branching sort of system of hominids and everything, was that significant as well in kind of casting any doubts on our, I suppose, special place?
Very much so, yeah. I think I've been born and raised in the UK. I'm 32 in a couple of days' time. I've learned about evolution at school. Like, it's nothing new to me. But what Yuval Noah Harari did in his book was enable me to see that actually it isn't just that we've jumped from ape to man, but there have been many, many steps in between. And I've always viewed that humans are this pinnacle, this kind of, they are created in the image of God, right? They are literally his image bearers, his gardeners here on earth to reflect him back into creation around us. But what this book did is it enabled me to begin to go, well, actually humans might be better in certain areas, but not necessarily better in other areas. And what makes us think that we're special? You know, you could say that we're able to kind of command our environment and that makes us special. Well, fair enough. But, you know, Homo erectus was able to control fire from a million years ago, and they were able to, you know, destroy things in their habitats to allow other things to grow. And this is this idea that, you know, what is it specifically about people, humans today, Homo sapiens, that gives us the right or the ability to say that we are special, that we are more important, that we are the pinnacle of something? And that, you know, the way that he sketched that book definitely did bring a lot of challenges to this idea of purpose and potential.
Coming back to you, Andrew, I'd like to find out about whether doubts have factored at all in your Christian faith, perhaps not quite in, you know, at the same magnitude that they have for Sam, but what's been your experience there? And then we'll go on to talk about Sapiens and so on.
Well, on the matter of evolution, I've never had a big problem that God could choose to create through a progressive mechanism that went from the most primitive unicellular organisms through an evolutionary process through the different hominids. That has never really been a big problem. And in fact, I think the scientific evidence now for the hominid evolution, I mean, it's getting more complicated as I understand it by the day, but we now I think scientifically can be sure we've got a certain amount of Neanderthal DNA in our own genome, as we have probably the Denisovian DNA. And so I've never had a problem that God might have chosen to create in that way. I know many Christians have had problems over trying to understand Genesis in terms of a literal interpretation, because that wouldn't fit. But I have never seen that as the raison d'etre of Genesis. It seems to me that if picking up on Sam, it is telling a story. I happen to believe it's God's story. And he is using that language of Genesis story to bring out the key theological truths, of which one I do believe is that Homo sapiens is the pinnacle of the creative process. And I've often seen the two accounts of creation in Genesis as the first account in Genesis 1 being very much the creation of the biological shell, Homo sapiens, through a process of evolution. And then the Genesis 2 account, God created man out of the dust of the earth, and God breathed his spirit into him and he became a living being. In a sense, I've seen it at some point in the evolutionary history, God interacting in a unique way. If you like, it becomes Homo sapiens divinus or something. I don't know what you want to call it. And it's at that point the biblical story begins. Now, you know, that is not everybody will be happy from that from a Christian point of view, but I've always felt that the truth revealed in Scripture and the truth revealed in science must be compatible. And that is the way I bring it together. And I think many other Christians would do the same.
Mm. And in that sense, the science itself and Scripture haven't caused you to doubt per se. I mean, have you come across many people who have gone through similar journeys to Sam, who have felt, you know, I just can't reconcile at this point, at least, this account of the nature of the way humans have come to be? And, you know,
I have.
Go ahead.
Yeah, on two areas. One is I have seen Christians brought up in a very narrow Christian tradition and have been presented with, if you don't believe a literal six-day creation, then you can't be a Christian. And that has caused them just to give up their faith, because if I've got to believe that, you know, it's six impossible, 10 impossible things before breakfast. I mean, and I do get very passionate about that. And one of my great desires is to help the church understand that science is not a threat, and, you know, you can actually believe God created through evolution and do justice to Scripture. So that's one area I've seen people lose their faith. The other is, and it's interesting Sam mentioned this, on the whole issue of suffering. It is one of the biggest issues. The Odyssey is not something any of us have got simple solutions for. And I have seen people whose faith has been shipwrecked on that. But the strange thing is I've seen other people coming to faith through that because they have recognized that neither with faith nor without faith can you really explain suffering. It's something we know we experience. And you can have lots of
Yeah, problems. That's really helpful. I wonder, Sam, though, where do you sort of, where I suppose where Andrew sees, you know, this sort of confluence between the evolutionary story and obviously being able to understand it in the genre of literature and so on, that he sees Genesis as telling this particular story of God's dealing with humanity. You obviously have felt that there's something that doesn't make sense. It's almost as though you seem to be saying that, okay, but if I just viewed this in naturalistic terms, it would make better sense than trying to overlay a kind of theistic or Christian story on it. Is that what I hear you saying, Sam?
Currently, I mean, I always say very much that I'm any and that I'm trying to kind of honestly reflect on these things. I'm not trying to say I'm absolutely right, but from what I can tell, you know, Andrew kind of talks about God's breath breathing into humans, ruach, this idea that God imbues himself within people. And, you know, that was such a powerful thing for me when I was a Christian, is this idea that, you know, every breath I breathe is going back to God, like it is his in the first place, and to him it does return. And that's really interesting and really cool. And I wish that was true. But for me, I can't help but see that there happens to be so much that can be explained outside of this kind of God's Christian framework, that it can't be within it unless I'm missing something. And this is the thing that I'm trying to search for. Like, what is it that I've missed, which could link it back to the biblical narratives? I mean, I've got no issue with Genesis not being a literal 6-day creation, 7-day rest. That's absolutely fine. It wasn't really something for me that I had problems with. I was very much raised with that mindset, which is absolutely fine. So I don't have a problem with it not being 6 days and being, you know, millions of years, billions of years and stuff. So yeah.
But you don't see this idea that Andrew said he does see, which is the idea of Homo sapiens, us as the pinnacle, in a sense. You don't necessarily see that follows from when you look at the diverse history of Earth.
That's a great question. I think I can't help but view it through the lens of sin as well, though. So potentially that, you know, humans are the current pinnacle, if that's how you want to view it. But for me, it's if you're a Christian, that's intrinsically linked to this idea of the fall of sin, of this beginning of this problem. And so I kind of want to ask this question, which is, if you were to get a piece of string and you were to take it all the way back to the very beginning, so the Big Bang, or everyone's used, the moment God breathed creation into existence, and you were to pull that string all the way through to where we are today, now as a human here today, you would have that bit of string and it would be loose, because at some point humans have sinned, right? That string has been cut and humanity has made a decision to become gods themselves and to reject God's message and his way of living. I want to ask the question, if God is real and there is this idea that we have sinned, or humanity has made the decision to reject God, where that string was cut, where in the timeline did it happen? Because for me, that would then make a lot of sense of, okay, well, at this point, in this moment in time, humans decided as the pinnacle of God's creation that they were going to reject the creator and begin to live in a way that was displeasing or subversive to his message, living as gods themselves. But I can't see that. I can't reconcile that. So that's kind of my take on that. It's probably a bit of a weird curveball, but
anyway. No. I mean, I think it is a common question when people are dealing with that whole question of what is the fall? What does it mean for people to be separated from God if it's not in the sort of the literal Adam and Eve in a garden and a talking snake sort of sense? Now, Andrew, I don't know whether you sort of want to tackle that one, give a sense of how you approach that whole issue.
I think it's a very good question, and I think one of the things that I feel the whole evolutionary process, and indeed that so much of modern science has shown this, is that creation is very open. It's full of possibilities. They're very creative possibilities, and the evolutionary process has created some extraordinary creatures, plants, animals. It's also producing really weird ones. I suppose I see the openness of creation as almost necessary for God's purpose, ultimately, of having beings that have free will and can truly choose to relate to him. Of course, once you have that openness, that possibility comes into play, that you can do something different from what was intended. And so I see the account of the fall in Genesis as a pictorial representation of us making our own choices. God's given us that possibility, and we have chosen to go our own way. Then the consequences of that just permeate throughout the whole of human history. Now, what happened before that point I suppose I see Adam as representing the point in our evolution where God reveals himself, we could become aware of God, and therefore we could become aware of the possibility of disobeying what he wanted us to do. So I suppose that's where I come from. And we could go down all sorts of avenues about how that might lead to suffering and so on. If you wanted to explore it.
Yeah. I mean, a quick response from you, Sam, and then we'll go to a break, and we'll start to open up the whole issue of the religious side of this as well, whether these are sort of just the stories that also developed as humanity developed in that sense. But did you want to respond to that first?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's just, I think just two quick points. I think the first one would be kind of, you know, I'm not sure God has revealed himself. To some people, God has, but there have been many different groups of people that have experienced or expressed God in different ways. And we might say that the Yahweh, the Judeo-Christian God is the God, and therefore he is worthy of our worship and praise. But my second point would be kind of, I believe if God is all powerful and all loving, he is able to literally make himself known to absolutely everybody on earth and also imbue them with free will. So we have the ability to completely know he's real. And we also have the ability to go, I want nothing to do with that. Now, in all honesty, as far as I'm aware, I'm obviously not in the situation, but I can only guess, as far as I'm aware right now, if I knew that God was real and was there, I would want to worship him. Now, a lot of people would not want to do that I've heard on YouTube and stuff, but that's not really me. I'm very much interested in God if he's real, but it's that fact that I don't know that he's real, so that I can't then therefore go and accept him as my Lord and Savior. That'd just be my two short points.
I'd love to come back on that, if we keep that in our minds as we go to a break here, Sam, because I think there's a whole bag of stuff we could go down, different routes we could go down here, but I'd love to talk about sort of what it would take, I suppose, for you to sort of feel like you could invest faith again in that sense in God, and what the specifics are, I suppose, of the intellectual questions that seem to need to be answered before you could sort of go down that road again. We're talking today, probably in what it will be eventually quite a varied conversation, but certainly the main thrust of it is whether faith can survive an evolutionary understanding of humanity and religion. Because after Sam Davis read Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari, it sort of started a journey of doubt, which has led to him finally saying he doesn't feel he can call himself a Christian any longer. He has a blog and a podcast called When Belief Dies. I'll make sure there's a link to it from today's show. He's in conversation with Andrew Hailstrap today, Professor of Biochemistry at the University of Bristol. We're on Unbelievable, and we'll be back in just a moment's time.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's edition of the show. I'm joined by Sam and Andrew. Sam is a former Christian who started a blog and podcast in the last year or so called When Belief Dies, chronicling his own journey and doubts around Christianity. Now, what's interesting is I find Sam a very honest blogger and podcaster, and he's equally willing to put the case for Christianity when he finds something that actually causes him to doubt the naturalistic account. Maybe we'll come to that towards the end of today's show, because we've had some interesting conversations on that front, Sam. Andrew Hailstrap, Professor of Biochemistry at the University of Bristol, is with us as well. He's a Christian who's been in science, most of his life. And we've been talking just in that last section about some of the issues around the evolutionary story versus the Bible and that kind of thing, Andrew. And particularly Sam, sort of in that final part there, sort of asking that question, what would it take in a sense for him to believe again? Why couldn't God just make himself obvious to him? He doesn't think there would be a free will issue as far as he can see. Takes us down some interesting sort of questions. But I'd be extremely interested as we start this second section, why you are a Christian, Andrew, why you believe God does make sense of things.
Yes, I think there are two levels to answer this. First of all, why I think God exists, and then secondly, why I'm a Christian, because they don't have to go together. There are many other people who believe in God who aren't Christians. And I think one of the things that makes me sympathetic towards the view of God is we live in an incredibly improbable universe, and that's not just me as a Christian saying that. I mean, you'll have even Dawkins, you've got people like Fred Hoyle, that they all agree that as I think Fred Hoyle put it, someone's monkeyed around with the constants in physics to make them just perfect. There's no doubt that we live in a fine-tuned universe that's very improbable. And of course, there are two simple ways of looking at it. One is, well, of course, we're here. So even if a cure occurred without a creator, so what? I mean, we're here. It must have happened. Whereas the other side is say, well, perhaps that fine tuning suggests that there was something behind it. And I quite like this argument that a lot of scientists have. Well, Occam's razor says the simplest hypothesis to fit the facts is the best hypothesis. And I think that's very true. Occam was a Franciscan friar, and I think said it is best to do with less. It's unwise to do with more than what can be done with less, effectively. So a lot of scientists would say, well, hang on, surely introducing God is an extra complexity. If we don't need him, if we can explain it by a purely naturalistic mechanism, why add this extra complication? And I quite like Professor Keith Ward's approach to this, where very simplistically he says, well, just for a moment, hypothesize the imponderable mystery that God exists. If God exists, he provides an explanation for the numerous other imponderable mysteries that we have in terms of the Big Bang, in terms of the creation of life in the first place, all of which are very improbable, the evolutionary process over however many billions of years creating life as we know it. These are all incredibly improbable. So you've got two possibilities, lots of improbabilities, imponderable mysteries, or one imponderable mystery, which is the simple hypothesis. Now, I agree, it's not a cast iron argument, but I find it quite a persuasive one that perhaps hypothesizing the existence of God is not so silly after all. And then I suppose I come back to some of the moral arguments that if there is no God, what is underlying all our sense of purpose and meaning in the world? We do, I think, each of us feel that we make free decisions, that we have purpose. And yet, if you take a purely evolutionary view, are we not just the random banging together of molecules in our brain that happen to produce certain responses to certain stimuli that we get from outside? Or could it be that meaning and purpose is injected by that creator God? And then I come to the whole Christian side of it, and I find the teaching of Jesus, as well as his death and resurrection, persuasive, and particularly the resurrection. I do think that is something you can't just dismiss. You can't prove it, but I do find the evidence quite strong. So that's, I suppose, some of the reasons that I am. And can I just, there was a lovely quote from C.S. Lewis, which it's actually Alistair McGrath that pointed this one in his biography of Lewis. He says, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. And I suppose my faith seems to make sense of not just the scientific endeavor, but of the meaning and purpose of life, the basis of morality. So
yes.
I could go on. But
yes, yes. I mean, I'll come back to you, Sam. I'm sure you've got plenty to say to that. And these are the issues you cover all the time on your own podcast anyway. I mean, but everything that Andrew's just said there, especially around the meaning and the purpose side, is so interesting in as much as Yuval Noah Harari has things to say about that in Sapiens. And one quote that I've been popping up quite a lot recently is this one from the book, where he says, as far as we can tell, from a purely scientific viewpoint, human life has absolutely no meaning. Humans are the outcome of blind evolutionary processes that operate without goal or purpose. Our actions are not part of some divine cosmic plan. And if planet Earth were to blow up tomorrow morning, the universe would probably keep going about its business as usual. And so, in a sense, I see Yuval very much in that Dawkins New Atheist camp, saying, yeah, the universe does not owe you a purpose. And anything we do ascribe in terms of value, meaning, purpose, right and wrong, is just the outworking of blind evolutionary forces. It can be boiled down ultimately to matter in motion. So where did you find that persuasive when you read that, Sam? Or have you struggled with that particular way of approaching the whole thing as well?
Good question. Gosh, where to start? I think There's so much in this. It's really quite a complicated matter. So, I mean, you know, philosophers have been dealing with these sorts of things for a long time. So Bertrand Russell, for instance, in his book, Why I'm Not a Christian, has a lot to say about the naturalistic framework upon which life makes sense. Like you cannot imbue hope and meaning and purpose outside of a naturalistic framework for you to be a naturalist, and therefore those things will burn when the world dies. Like those things aren't going to be here forever. But he also makes the point that it's impossible to live as if that's the finite and final reason or final destination of these things. Like even if that is true, that when this world or this universe ends in its heat death, that life is going to be extinct and all our plans and all our dreams and all our aspirations and ambitions have gone. It's impossible to live like that's the case. So as people, we naturally create meaning and purpose and desire and drive to give us these things. I mean, Sam Harris has this really interesting quote where he talks about purpose is a, let me get this right. Purpose is a philosophical, purpose is a psychological problem that we make philosophical. So purpose is a psychological problem that we make philosophical. And it's this idea that we are consistently looking at philosophy to help us understand purpose, or actually for Sam Harris, and something I've been experiencing as well within kind of meditation, like mindfulness, this sort of idea of being aware of your thoughts and your feelings as they're arising. Actually, in that place, we're able to actually experience and understand purpose in a completely different light to us being in this state of angst or worry about whether or not this career I'm going down is the right thing, or are my children happy at school, or how am I going to pay for the next lot of shopping that's going to happen tomorrow or whatever. Like we create so many things out of our desires and our fears and our panics. And actually, if we were to step back and go, what do these things actually mean? Do they make a difference to us? Arguably, no. And I think that's really hard to swallow sometimes, but I can also understand that, you know, we have to look at both sides. Like if Christianity is real and there is a God that is creating purpose and narrative and meaning, fantastic. Let's look at that. Let's engage with that. Let's understand how that came to be. But if that isn't the case, we've got the other side where meaning, purpose, and rationality are based within a naturalistic, materialistic framework. And actually, what does that mean? And I mean, I try and look at this Christian element all the time in my conversations. And I also try and look at this sort of naturalistic element as well and go, well, if this is true, does it actually affect how I live? And as far as I can tell from lots of the philosophers and the people that know far more than me in the books and the videos that I watch and all the different areas, podcasts you can get involved with, these people know so much more than me, but it doesn't seem possible to live as if meaning and purpose and things aren't real. So like one of the big things that I struggle with is it, and I think Christopher Hitchens said it really well when he said, even if you can prove that a God began everything, that he's the one that fine-tuned everything, he got it to the state we're in today, all your work is still ahead of you to prove that the Judeo-Christian God is the real God. And I think that's a big element, because obviously today in the West, especially, a lot of our morals and the secular ideologies that we even live up to are still, I believe, grounded within a very Western idea of Christianity. I threw an email before the show started, Justin, just kind of talking about this idea of how long we, as in Homo sapiens, have actually understood God and actually had this idea of him. And just to kind of just to rustle it off now, is this idea that humans, Homo sapiens, have been around for 200,000 years. And if we can say, okay, well, the Old Testament, so the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, were probably written down about 1,500 BC. So that's 3,500 years ago. And if we were to go, okay, let's say 1,000 years before that, there was some sort of oral tradition of the Torah. So they were sharing these stories, they were propagating them amongst themselves. So we have 4,500 years that humanity have known or been engaging with this idea of Yahweh, imbuing them with meaning and being his image bearers and being called to go out into the world and be his salt and light and his people amongst the nations. That's only 2.25% of human history. And then Jesus comes along, who's meant to be the one that clarifies it all and gives us our complete and utter understanding of God's reality. And then that's only 2,000 years ago, that's only 1% of human history that we've actually been able to understand or know who this God is. And I just find this... It's absolutely fine that it gives us hope and meaning and it's created this sort of world we live in. But I think it was Douglas Adams who said, it's almost like a puddle going, you know, isn't it amazing that I fit into this shape, that I am the way I am? And actually the puddle doesn't realize it's just there because that's where the rain fell. I mean, that could be an answer as well.
Sure. Where do you go with that, Andrew?
I suppose that there is a sense of which, as far back as we can tell, Homo sapiens has been asking these sort of questions about where and why. There's a fascinating book called Penultimate Curiosity, How Science Swims in the Slipstream of Ultimate Questions, which was written by Roger Wagner, who's an artist, and Andrew Briggs, who's a professor of nanoscience in Oxford. And they go right back looking at how science has progressed. And they even see in the early sort of cave paintings that inquiring mind. And how it seems as far back as we can go, we've been asking questions. Now, why did God only apparently reveal himself in a way that we understand however many, 4,000 years ago or whatever? I can't answer that question. The Bible talks about things like at the right time. And I don't know any more what that means, other than I am in a position now where I believe that revelation has been made and it makes sense. I can't answer for what happened to my Neanderthal forebears, but I can answer to what I know now, and it makes sense to me now.
I suppose the wider point that Sam's coming from here is his concern that we're always, wherever point we find ourselves in the various epochs that mark, human's evolution and so on, people have been, whether it be the ancient Egyptians or others before them or before them, making some sense of their place in the world according to the data they had around them. And very often that will involve some kind of supernatural element. And I think, I, as far as I see it, Yuval Noah Harari and many others besides Sam Harris and others have all made this point that we can, God didn't create man created God. It's a way of making sense of their place. But we've reached a point in our evolution where we no longer need those kinds of stories necessarily. And that, I suppose that's the wider point. Are these just myths that help us to get along in society, to develop, evolved cultures and everything else? Does Christianity ultimately, can it be explained away in that kind of way, in your view, Andrew?
I come back, as I often do on these things, to one of the central tenets of the Christian faith, which is the resurrection. Because if that occurred, you can't just explain it away. Paul himself said that if Christ did not rise from the dead, our faith is in vain. And I remember hearing John Polkinghorne speak about this, and that was the thing he came back to. And I think many of us who are Christians say we would, I think, struggle if we didn't have the resurrection. And I do think the evidence for the resurrection is good. I'm very interested. I don't know if Sam's read there is No God, but the No crossed out with an A in it by Anthony Flew, who, as you'll be aware, changed from his atheist views, humanist views, to becoming probably a deist more than a theist. But I found it very interesting that he writes his book in What I Used to Believe and What I Believe Now. But there's an appendix of the book, which is Tom Wright talking about the evidence for the resurrection, which Flew found very impressive. And it's one of actually the best summaries of the evidence of the resurrection I think I've read. It's only about 30 pages at the end of that book. But I do think that's where perhaps the cornerstone of my faith, because I do agree with Sam that you can explain these things in other ways, but you can't really explain the resurrection away. I don't think you can. And if the resurrection was real, then it adds credence to the whole rest of the story.
Yes. I remember this came up in a funny way in a debate I hosted between Alistair McGrath and Brett Weinstein a good year and a half ago now for our last series of The Big Conversation. And Brett's point is rather similar in a way, potentially, to Yuval Noah Harari's and yours here, Sam, that religion has been a useful thing culturally and socially, but not metaphorically true, but not actually true, is his view. And one person in the Q&A in the audience sort of asked this question. It wasn't very useful for all the people who got killed for their faith in Jesus Christ, was it? It doesn't necessarily, the Christian story itself isn't necessarily, arguably, the kind of story you would make up to kind of create an easier society for yourself, because it went against, in so many ways, it stood against the predominant, you know, pagan narratives, you know, within which it came into, and obviously stood, you know, got them into trouble with the Jewish authorities as well that they came out of. So I suppose I've had the similar feeling as Andrew here, Sam, that was Christianity really such a sort of helpful, you know, way of gelling culture together? Why did it become popular, given that it was in a sense so very countercultural at its birth?
That's a question I was not expecting. I think for me, for the resurrection and these sorts of things, I mean, I've got so much reading to do in this. I'm actually hoping to have NT Wright on my podcast this year. Fingers crossed it happens. We'll see. We're in conversation about it. But this sort of idea that the resurrection has loads of weight behind it, I don't necessarily have a problem with people saying that. But what I would love to see is a historian come to faith because of the research they've done in the resurrection. Like someone who is not a Christian, who comes and looks at the weight and evidence of the resurrection, goes, it must be true, and becomes a Christian. Because what I see a lot of the time is Christians claim the resurrection is true and putting weight behind it. But very, very rarely do I see non-Christians saying, well, here's the evidence of resurrection, I therefore do now believe in Christianity. I mean, if we could have that and we could see that, I mean, I'd love to talk to that person and see what evidence they found. And maybe that person exists. Maybe someone on the chat live stream or who listens to the podcast can tell us where that is. Because that'd be really interesting. But it's those sorts of... It's those sorts of ideas. I mean, I was kind of talking as well before we started about this idea that we don't like to let go of things that we believe, and people believe the Bible is literally the word of God. I know I've got a really good friend who says to me that the whole Bible is inerrant, because a section of the Bible says that section is inherent. They literally read that passage as meaning the entire sweep of Scripture to be inherent, and it's this idea that we like to live in the things that give us comfort and hope, and Christianity can't not be a hope-giving narrative in the world that we've allowed it to create. We've allowed it to be the bedrock upon which our understanding of morality, reason stands. Like, we can't help but do that. And so, I mean, I was talking about Lucy, who is this could be a bit of a curveball, but just bear with me. So Lucy is essentially a figure that's really well known now within paleoanthropology. So Lucy is a human ancestor, 3.5 million years old. So she was about 3.5 feet tall, had a really, really, really small skull, so had a really small brain, but was a biped. So she walked standing up, which kind of was a massive deal for when she was found back in the 70s. And this guy that found her, Dr. Johansson, he had a real issue trying to help the community of paleoanthropologists understand the impact that this discovery had made. And they were refusing to listen to him. They're refusing to take it on board. And he had to gather so much information, have so many conversations, so much chat, to begin to shift the idea that actually humans were able to, or ancient hominins were able to walk upright before they developed large brains. The idea was large brain came first, then came the upright walking. Well, actually, this shifted that entirely. Here's a great book on that called Lucy. So go away and look at that for sure. And that kind of goes into why that happened. But it's idea that shifting the understanding and the narratives that we have is really hard to do. So, okay, I'm very happy to look at the evidence of the resurrection. I'm very happy to read that 30-page section by NT Wright, and hopefully talk to NT Wright and just, you know, in engage with this stuff. I know Mike Lacona and people like that have written vast amounts on this, but I would love to see a non-Christian coming in and sweeping things up a bit, shifting the landscape, shifting our ideas, because that would really help me to see that there was something new or something that had brought enough weight to change the conversation.
I think I'm right in saying that Frank Morrison, who was actually a lawyer rather than a historian, did exactly that. He wrote the book Who Moved the Stone, because I believe he came at it as a non-Christian, wanting to disprove the resurrection, because he felt if he could disprove the resurrection, he would really scupper the Christian faith, and I would agree with him. And he ended up a believer. So that might be a book. It was a long time ago I read it, but it was called Who Moved the Stone. And certainly he came at it, I'm pretty sure, anyway, from that direction.
Yes. I suppose it depends what your level of sort of what level of evidence you need here. What's yeah. I mean, I've certainly heard of people for whom the evidence for the resurrection has been an important part of them coming to faith. I mean, a more modern example than Frank Morrison is obviously someone like Lee Strobel, whose book, on that was really what launched his career as a Christian apologist. But equally, I know of many people who are adult converts to Christianity, and the resurrection and other factors have often been part of that. I wouldn't say that for any of them necessarily it was just the resurrection and, you know, inevitably, I think there are other things that come into play. But I suppose all of this talk makes me ask for you, Sam, what would it take you? I mean, are you saying that the only thing that could really make you convinced now is if God gave you some sort of absolutely incontestable evidence of his existence, and then you'd be happy to say, yes, now I'm happy to worship you, God, even if other people weren't or whatever? I don't know. Are you setting the bar too high there, if that's kind of suddenly where you say the evidence has to be? Why has it changed so dramatically from where you once were, I suppose, where evidently you believed genuinely, but you didn't seem to require the amount of kind of absolute cast iron proof that you're looking for now in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, I'd start with the bar and then kind of talk about the evidence. So I think the reason the bar shifted is because of my understanding of history. I don't know it all. I'm not really clever in this sort of area or anything. I've just read a few popular books and watched some YouTube videos and listened to podcasts and worked things through. And it's just this idea, for instance, that you know, Homo erectus wasn't able to laugh and fight and wasn't able to share stories in their own format and wasn't able to kind of control fire and live in family and community. And I'm trying to work out from this, at what points do humans become special? What is it about us that imbues us with God's presence, his ruach, as Andrew mentioned before, his breath? And when I can understand that, I'm going to be a little bit more kind of accepting of Christianity and how God works. But that bar shifted because I've realized that actually we aren't as special as we think we are, as far as I can tell. So that's why that shifted. And then this kind of evidence side, so this is probably where the non-Christians listening are going to start getting annoyed. I think I really enjoy looking at this sort of what would it take to convince me. I think that the things that have kind of really got me to go, huh, okay, that I wasn't expecting, are things like the argument from reason or looking at logic. So logic isn't something I'm particularly familiar with, and I've never really engaged with it. And there's this great bit in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe where the professor or Diggory, as you later find out, turns around and says, "Why don't they teach logic in these schools anymore?" And this idea that you can have these sort of syllogisms, which as they come together and if they're sound, actually mean their conclusion, actually come to something. And I know people like William Lane Craig and also atheists kind of like have these sorts of conversations, and those sorts of things I don't know much about, but I'm really looking forward to investigating those more and seeing if they're able to sway my beliefs. But I think when you talk about the evidence for what will and will not convince you, I don't think we are actually in control of what will and will not convince me. So I can provide for you an argument for something, say it's, you know, to buy a new car. I think that getting an electric car is better than getting a diesel car for obvious reasons. If you disagree with me, you're wrong, by the way. No, I'm joking. We're all out our opinions. But basically I can provide a argument for something, but whether or not that convinces you, I'm not able to control. And actually, I don't think you're able to control either. But as I kind of say things to you, maybe you'll go away and look at stuff, maybe someone else will say something to you, maybe you'll see an advert, these things culminate together, and eventually you find yourself thinking, actually, you know, by 2030 hopefully there'll be more electric cars, and by 2050 we hope to get rid of all petrol and diesel cars or whatever, so maybe I should invest in electric cars now. And we begin to shift our mindset and our ability to believe in something, to think it's a valid point. And I guess that would be, for me, it would be that sort of as I come across things, I can engage with them and see if they shift other kind of prepositions or things I hold. I know Alvin Plantinga talks about these defeaters. So if I can find a defeater for my defeater, then I'll be able to then question that belief that I held before in a different light. It's about shifting our mindsets and also looking to have our mindset shifted. Like, I'm so tired, genuinely so tired of Christians and non-Christians sitting in echo chambers, just having their point of view thrown back at them with different sorts of quirks or memes or whatever. Like, I want to understand what someone believes, because when you understand what someone believes, you can sit yourself in that camp and go, How does that affect what I think? Why do I not think like that? What am I missing in my life? Or what would my life look like if I was living in that position? And then from that place, hopefully you're able to be as honest as you can be and actually look at what they're presenting. That'll be my answer.
Yeah. We'll come back to Andrew for more on this in just a moment's time. We're just into our last break here, and we'll continue the story of Sam and what led him to sort of label himself, I suppose, sort of post-Christian, someone who lost his faith, and what it would take is essentially what we've been talking about just now to bring him back again. My other guest is Andrew Hailstrap, and we'll be back in just a moment's time.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. Before Justin continues his interesting conversation with Sam Devis and Andrew Hailstrap, I just wanted to thank everyone for their feedback this week. One of the things that I love about Unbelievable is how geographically diverse our listeners are. Justin received a tweet a few days ago from Cristiano Silva in Germany about the show that we recently aired with a Norwegian atheist and a Swedish Christian. He said this: "Unbelievable is a fantastic show and I'm usually blessed by it. But this episode about secularism in the Scandinavian countries was food for my thoughts. Great discussion. I can't recommend it enough." And then he added a huge thumbs up emoji. Now, I'm sure many of us in Europe have been thinking and praying for our friends across the pond recently. It's been an eventful few weeks in US politics. And last week, Justin invited Shane Claiborne and Johnny Moore onto Unbelievable to discuss some of those recent events, including Trump's impeachment and the Capitol Hill riots. They also looked at whether the US church is in the grip of political idolatry. So many of you got in touch to share your thoughts about that programme, and I'll be sharing some of this feedback at the end of the episode. Still to come tonight on Premier Christian Radio, you can hear The Profile. And this week, Christianity Magazine's Sam Hales is speaking to Scottish singer-songwriter Steph McLeod. At one point, Steph was homeless and struggled with alcohol and drug addiction. You can hear the fascinating story of how God completely transformed Steph's life tonight at 8 p.m. or listen on The Profile podcast at premierchristianradio.com/podcast. Next week on Unbelievable, we're going to be taking a look at some of the most difficult passages in the Bible. Justin will be joined by atheist Michael Wiseman and Christian Dan Kimball. It's going to be a fascinating and insightful discussion, so do tune in at 6 p.m. on Premier Christian Radio next Saturday or via the Unbelievable podcast or YouTube channel. But for now, let's get back to the show.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of the show. We've been talking to Sam Devis, who's a former Christian, in recent years underwent a big deconstruction, started a blog and podcast about it. I've had the privilege of being on there. It's called When Belief Dies. We'll make sure there's a link to that. You're getting some big hitters as well on the show, Sam. You've had Alistair McGrath on quite recently, and big names in the atheist world, Matt Dillahunty. What's all this in aid of, ultimately? And I'll come back to Andrew in a moment's time. Did you just start this blog and podcast just to work through where you're at and to just kind of get some sense of, could I believe this again? I mean, do you feel like you could potentially come back to faith if the right person said the right thing, the right bit of evidence was put in front of you? Where's this all leading in the end?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I started When Belief Dies because I wanted the ability to have kind of honest conversations about faith, religion, and life. Like, I want to be able to have my space, which is my blog, to kind of process where I am and what's going on. And that's actually now 2 years behind where I currently am, which is really weird. I just wrote loads of blog posts over the few years and then decided to start publishing them. And then the podcast itself is to have as many people who have a voice in this conversation on as possible, to hear their thoughts, to hear their ideas about a lot of the things that I struggle with. So purpose, reason, rationality, those sorts of things. Because I want to be able to try my best to understand what everyone says and to then be able to, from that position, see what I think and take a step forward. I for some reason, struggle to make uninformed steps. I think I've believed a lot of things because people have told them to me in the past, and actually having the ability to hear what other people think, like Alice McGrath or Matt Dillahunty or, you know, David C. Smalley or whoever, to come on and say this is what I think about this, this is what I think about that, just helps me and hopefully the listener process some of our natural inclinations and makes us go, well, why do I not agree with that? Or why do I agree with that? Am I just agreeing with it because it's my worldview? Or am I agreeing with it for some other reason? And actually begin to have these sorts of conversations. So really it's a processing tool.
Yeah. Who do you tend to find you agree with the most, the atheists or the Christians?
Oh, that's a good question. I on different things agree with different people in all honesty. So I had a conversation with Alistair McGrath, and I know Andrew was briefly chatting to us about that off air, and I found some of the things he said to be really interesting. Like he said things in a way that I hadn't heard before, and I'm still processing that with him offline and still working things through. Even when you were on the show, Justin, I think you said something along the lines of, you know, basically apologetics doesn't work unless the person who's listening to it wants it to work. Like, and that's, you know, that's quite a big thing to kind of go away and think about and go, well, you know, do I just not believe in God because I just don't want to believe in God? Is that true? Is there a part of my heart that I can say that's true about? And, you know, being able to have those conversations and to understand that, I think is really helpful. So I think different people from different worldviews bring different things, which are challenging and confirming in different ways.
Andrew, where do you come on this? Because I guess a lot of people would love, you know, and I think apologetics can appeal to people who would like it all to be certain and for there to be no sort of mysteries, but that we could all just agree, you know, God exists and we've got some copper bottomed arguments for that. That's not the way life goes, though, is it? So what's your view on how Christians should hold their faith when it comes to the fact that we don't have that kind of mathematical certainty when it comes to God and faith?
Well, one of the interesting things of talking to Sam is I'm much more used to talking to scientists who've never really thought about God at all or just dismissed him without perhaps thinking carefully enough about why he might exist. And so normally I'm talking from that angle. But whether you're coming from one direction or the other, the one thing that I'm sure of is you cannot argue someone in pure reason to faith. You can provide very good reasons to believe in God, but other people will say, well, they there are very good reasons for not believing in God. And at the end of the day, yeah, I find myself a bit like C.S. Lewis. I think it's in Surprised by Joy, where he describes his journey before he came to faith when he was an atheist. And he had lots of questions. And gradually he realized that actually he had more, that there were more answers in favor of God than against. So he made that leap of faith. And then living that life of faith out made more sense out of his life. And over time, he would begin to address some of the other questions. One thing I'm sure of, none of us will ever be able to answer all the questions there are. And reason is never going to provide all the answers. The faith is something of a mystery. The other thing I sometimes say to people is, you know, we're quite used to living, scientists are quite used to living with mystery. If you take something like quantum theory, I mean, there are mysteries there that we can't get our minds around. We know them to be true in the sense that we find evidence for, be it particle and wave characteristics of light. But actually getting our minds around it is very difficult. So, Yeah, I think that faith is a journey.
And it's interesting because just as there are different sort of pieces of evidence for Christianity that will convince someone and not convince another person at all, equally I find that certain objections to Christianity or God are very convincing to one person and not at all convincing to another. So, you know, you've both read the same book, Sapiens, and for you, Sam, it was a sort of, you know, real, you know, one that caused massive doubts to come up for Andrew. He can fit that way of looking at history perfectly easily into his Christian schema. So inevitably there's all kinds of other things apart from just some facts which are going on when we're evaluating, I guess, whether this is a compelling or objection or piece of evidence for faith, isn't there? I mean, it's interesting actually, because one of the interesting things that happened as we've talked this through off air over the last year or so, Sam, has been that we ended up having a conversation about determinism and free will. And then that led on to a conversation about the argument from reason. And we've already heard C.S. Lewis mentioned a couple of times now, but I encourage you to go and read Miracles by C.S. Lewis. And I was not expecting the reaction I got from you when you read that, which was, gosh, this might have changed my mind on the whole naturalism thing. I'm not sure it does make as much sense as, and which in a sense is an example of the power of apologetics potentially. That's because that is very much a class, you know, Lewis's apologetic for the fact that, well, certainly an apologetic against naturalism, materialism, without going into the depths of explaining what the argument is, which we just don't have time for, sadly. It was interesting that for me, it felt like, well, Sam is very much open to where things might lead. It didn't feel like you'd close the door on God at that point. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to close any door. Like, I don't want to say that, you know, that's it, I'm done on this God stuff and move on. Like, I'm engaging in conversations as much as I can do with as many people as I can. And I think the big thing about that book by C.S. Lewis is it opened up a whole can of worms I didn't think was there. And, you know, a lot of people just say, well, that's just evolution, just, you know, our reason and our rationality and morality and all that sort of stuff is just based within an evolutionary framework, and our psychology built upon that, and that's just how it is. And actually, I think, you know, there is some things that C.S. Lewis says in that book which are very challenging, and that other people have then taken on and actually kind of worked further in. So, you know, I mean, books that I've not read that I want to read, there's a really interesting one by Victor Rappert, thanks. Yeah. Called C.S. Lewis's Dangerous Idea. And then there's also Knowledge and Christian Belief by Alvin Plantinga. And these sort of books delve into areas that I don't know much about, but I find absolutely fascinating. And, you know, I want to go and dive off the deep end and actually look at this stuff, because if there is this idea that essentially our reason can't just be hooked within the naturalistic world for reasons X, Y, and Z, then I want to go and look at those reasons X, Y, and Z, and why people are saying within the Christian worldview that our reason can't be just linked within naturalism. And that's really interesting. A lot of people just go, well, it is linked within naturalism because it's just linked within evolution, that's the end of it. But then I challenge them to go and read Miracles by C.S. Lewis, honestly read it. I read it three or four times just to kind of really go, what's my brain saying to me here? And then work out what the next steps are. How can you explore the things that challenge you more? And if you don't push those challenging doors, those challenging tracks of thought, you're never going to learn what you really believe. And that's, for me, like, well, one of the greatest things about this world is we're able to go away and find this stuff out. Like, who doesn't want to do that? Like, it's just crazy.
Well, it's been a really fascinating conversation with you, Sam, and with you, Andrew. Thank you very much both for being on the show with me. I guess the one question I kind of that's hanging over all this is that one that we've sort of talked about a bit there, Sam. But what would it take? I suppose, barring God doing that, I'm here and giving you some indisputable evidence of his existence and not somehow taking away your free will in the process. Do you feel like, I don't know, is it just that you'll know when you know the thing that allows you to take that step of faith? And will it still involve faith? I mean, would you agree that we're never going to be guaranteed a sort of certainty when it comes to God in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, I would say most things, not everything. I don't think maths necessarily fits into this, and maybe logic as well, but most things require faith. You have to have faith that you're not just a brain in a vat somewhere being processed. Like, you just do. And that's really challenging. A lot of people don't, like, that's they're done now. They're going to tap out and go, that's enough of that. But the reality is that you need faith to believe pretty much any premise. And it's about the level of faith required against the premise that is being presented. And for me, I just need a little bit more evidence and a little bit more understanding and explanation about some of my defeaters, as I mentioned before, to be able to actually carry on and step back into a framework of belief. Now, whether it'll be the kind of conservative Christianity I came from before, I really don't think so, based on what I have learned. But I'm not going to rule it out. I don't know for certain. It might very well be. And this is a journey, right? And I want to kind of essentially blog and podcast this journey through, so that wherever I do land, if there is such a thing as landing, people can go back and look and go, well, what was it that shifted this opinion? Or who did he speak to? Or what happened? Not because I've got all the answers, but because I want to track it so that other people, 100, 200, 1,000 years time, can go, what went on in the 21st century for people to lose and then get their faith? I think it'd be fascinating.
Well, maybe they'll unearth this like they unearthed Lucy in 1.5 million years and say, that was back when they had these things called podcasts. Andrew, thank you very much for being on the show as well. Any final thoughts as we close this one out?
Just that I totally agree with Sam that we must keep open to asking questions. I was impressed when Alistair McGrath was speaking with you. He was saying exactly this, that you need to understand where the other person's coming from if you're going to be able to have any chance of persuading them that perhaps the Christian faith is real. So I'm all for this sort of conversation. And I get very frustrated when I hear Christians just closing off. You know, you've got to believe this, full stop. It's putting a millstone round the neck.
Well, I've really enjoyed the conversation too. It's already been recommended by both of us, Sam, but just for the record, if you're listening and you'd like to go and check out When Belief Dies, we'll make sure the link is with today's show. So go and have a look at the blog, listen to the podcast. You go back in the archive, you'll hear myself and Sam having a conversation. Very good episode, as we've mentioned, with Alistair McGrath and lots of atheists and agnostics and others who you've had on the show as well. So I think you're a really interesting, fair sort of person when it comes to having those conversations. So I have appreciated them, Sam. For now, Andrew and Sam, thank you very much for being with me on today's show.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you for listening to Unbelievable. We would love to hear your thoughts about today's programme. Do drop us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or you can get in touch via social media at UnbelievableJB. Thank you so much to everyone who has been in touch with feedback about the last few programmes. I'm just really sorry that we can't read out everyone's messages on the show, because otherwise we would be here for a good few hours. If you've not had a chance yet to watch the video of Justin unboxing the YouTube silver play button that we were sent for reaching 100,000 subscribers on YouTube, then do check it out on either our social media platforms or our YouTube channel. There has been lots of lovely comments in response to this video, but I think probably my favourite is Simon Holmes on Twitter, who said this: "Unbelievably well deserved. See what I did there. Seriously though, huge congratulations. Never fails to be intellectually stimulating and a great example of how two parties can have a cordial discussion while simultaneously disagreeing on profound issues." Well, thanks for that, Simon. And I think a great example of having cordial discussion while disagreeing on profound issues was last week's show about Trump and US politics with Shane Claiborne and Johnny Moore. So many of you have been in touch to share your thoughts about the programme, and here is just a small sample of some of your feedback. Jeremy emailed to say, "This was a great discussion, and as usual, Justin, your facilitation created a good environment for open and honest debate. What a great example of how to lovingly hold some very different views. But it also brought some of my biases into sharp relief. The discussion challenged me. Am I the only person here in the UK who has a tendency to dismiss what is happening, in inverted commas, over there, and to have developed a slightly condescending attitude based on media soundbites that treat both Republicans and Democrats, and for that matter, American evangelicals, as homogenous groups? I have made lazy assumptions. In addition to the great theological insights, your show has created a much more sympathetic heart in me for our American cousins and an admiration for how deeply many think about political and societal issues and how well they can articulate their position, reflecting a breadth and variety of views that I had to date skimmed over. I need to hold a mirror to myself and the beam in my own eye. Thank you for being that mirror and keep up the good work." James got in touch over Facebook to say, "I wasn't willing to sacrifice America because Trump wasn't a soothsayer. We didn't elect a Christian to reform the church. We elected a man to preserve our republic. We didn't idolise him. We understood him. We related to him. We believe in him. We're thankful for him. We support him. How is loyalty idolising someone?" Matthew emailed in to say, "Hi Justin, really what I want to do is be a voice of defence for those of us here in the US who voted for Trump but do not like him. I think Shane made a very classic hasty generalisation logical fallacy that wrongly accuses the majority of Christians who voted for Trump and paints them in a very bad light, including myself. His line of logic went like this: 80% of American evangelical Christians voted for Donald Trump. Some evangelical leaders have made statements that Trump is our dream president and used phrases akin to viewing Trump as our savior. Therefore, it is very concerning that 80% of American Christians think Trump is their dream president and view him as their savior. This is absolutely not the case. Every single Christian I know who voted for Trump do not like him, do not support him, and reluctantly voted for him as the lesser of two evils. I do not like Donald Trump. I would never hold him up as an example of the character that represents America. And I most certainly would not say he is a good Christian example of a leader. However, that is not what I believe I am doing when I tick the box next to his name. If everyone is honest with themselves, they know they aren't truly voting for Donald Trump the man or Joe Biden the man. They are voting for the Republican candidate or the Democrat candidate. And plain and simple, I agree more with Republican policies. The direction Democrats are wanting to take the country involve things I think would be incredibly destructive to our country and things that I think would hinder us from living out the biblical framework of how to live. Things like prohibiting school choice, the teardown of the nuclear family, and the censorship of free speech are all things that I strongly oppose. And regardless of what name is next to the other box, that's the one I'm going to tick. The US has become a disgusting bipartisan political machine, and I hate to play into it by just voting for one of the two parties, but frankly that's all I can do to have any kind of impact. So even though it sucks to have to do, 80% of us Christians tick the box that we think would be less bad than the alternative, and Donald J. Trump happens to be the name next to it. It's ridiculous to believe that 80% of American Christians view Trump as our savior, or even think that he is a good man in any way. We just have a more conservative-leaning perspective on policies that would be best for our country. I think this reality doesn't necessarily make the American political situation any less grim, but it certainly shifts the source of that grimness off of Christians in America and onto the intangible political beast we've created. And Johnny is right, the way to solve these problems is to come together with people you disagree with and say, how can we come to a compromise? Rather than assuming the entire swathe of people on the other side of the aisle from you are racist, hateful, idolatrous people. Personally, I think Shane's worldview does much more harm than help to moving us forward. Thanks again, Justin, for the incredible work you're doing bridging gaps in our world and helping people see we all truly do have a common goal. Thanks for that, Matthew. And Doug Cruz got in touch over Facebook to say, I felt this whole podcast did not live up to the title. It was Shane talking like all of us would like to talk about this issue and Johnny trying to be politically correct and unwilling to call Trump out. The title of the podcast, Is the US Church in the Grip of Political Idolatry, was never answered and not really addressed. Very disappointing podcast. Sam Millen, on the other hand, on Twitter said, I really liked this conversation. Thanks again, Justin, for hosting it. I will never forget the line, I don't need a mask since God will protect, but I do need a gun. Michelle sent us a message on Facebook to say, I loved your podcast until you joined politics. Now I'm waiting until you return to apologists. And Jeremy emailed in to say, I've been listening to your show for a few months now and have learned so much. Thank you for your work on the show. I'd especially like to thank you for the debate between Shane Claiborne and Johnny Moore. Those guys did an extraordinarily good job of representing how each side sees the issues. And on Twitter, in response to the question, is the US church guilty of political idolatry? Ruth LeVay says, I thought I knew the answer to that one right away. And even though the conversation didn't change my mind, I still learned a lot. Lots of mixed opinion there. I'm just going to end with one more email from Dan, which was entitled So Good It's Unbelievable with a smiley face. And Dan says this. Dear Justin, I have been a listener now for more than 5 years. Love the show. Again, love in capital letters, the show. I am a Christian. I found your book to be a great collection of many of the stories and experiences which have affected and strengthened you in your faith. And it was refreshing, truly. I just listened to the latest show with Johnny and Shane. Incredible. It's the perfect setup for another show, in my opinion. I know it focused primarily on the US, but the how to come together conversations presented by both gentlemen, especially towards the end of the show, left me wanting more. Much more. I actually think the coming together could be applied not just to the US, but instead to all of us. I think your show is actually the spark reigniting the kind of positive discourse we've mostly forgotten. God bless you and God bless Unbelievable. Thank you so much to all of you for your comments and please do keep them coming. We love hearing what you've got to say about the shows. Do drop us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, or you can get in touch with us via social media at unbelievablejb. All that remains for me to say now is what's coming up on next week's show. Next week on Unbelievable, we will be looking at some difficult passages in the Bible. Justin will be joined by atheist Michael Wiseman and Christian Dan Kimball. You do not want to miss this, so tune in at 6 p.m. on Premier Christian Radio next Saturday, or you can listen via the Unbelievable podcast or YouTube channel.
You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.